Blog Talk Radio.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is working to help keep you and your community safe from the threat of novel or new coronavirus. Take the following everyday steps to help avoid the spread of all respiratory viruses. Wash your hands often with soap and water for at least 20 seconds. Cover your cough or sneeze with a tissue. Throw the tissue away and then wash your hands. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects or surfaces, such as remote controls and doorknobs. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. And stay home if you are sick. Call your healthcare provider if you develop fever, cough, or difficulty breathing. For more tips, visit cdc.gov.
Good morning, good morning. Welcome to Saturday Mornings with Joy Keyes. I'm your host. You can follow me at Joy Keyes on Twitter. You can also check me out on Facebook, Saturday Mornings with Joy Keyes, and on Instagram. Get lots of great pictures there. Check me out there, Saturdays with Joy Keyes. Well, right now, I have another guest from across the ocean. I'm going to merge her in. Good morning, Mina. We're on the air. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Good morning, Joy.
I was just letting the audience know I am stuck in the house well because of COVID, though. You know, COVID is like the big drama right now.
Oh, it definitely is. Everywhere in the world, it's a nightmare.
So how are you doing in London with that? How are you handling it? What's going on over there for you?
You know what? They're just easing the lockdown rules at the moment, and it's been quite terrifying because there's so much happening on a daily basis. There's a lot of violence, a lot of, bad public behavior. And so I think there's been like a buildup of aggression and frustration during the lockdown, and it feels as though it's all coming out now.
Yeah.
So it's concerning. Yeah.
Do you have to still wear masks? Do you have to wear masks?
No, they never enforced that here. And I'd say that most people in London aren't wearing masks unless they're commuting. Actually, you have to wear a mask if you're hopping on a bus or a train. But otherwise, I don't think people wear masks as much as you do over in the U.S., from what I've seen on the news and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, we have to wear masks like everywhere now in my state. They want everybody to wear masks going to the store, supermarket, even on the beach. They want you to wear a mask. They have open beaches.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's a good thing because the scientists seem to be saying that really does prevent the spread. So I think they'll probably have to implement that here as well eventually.
It's weird, though, because you're walking down the street, and you see people with these masks, and the first time it happened, it was really uncomfortable, it took away, you don't realize how much the face is important to communication.
Absolutely.
Even without saying a word, the face is so important.
Yes.
You need to see that face.
That's true. I had a bit of a preview into having masks around because I was a visiting lecturer in Hong Kong in 2016. And, they've been wearing masks out there. Well, at least they were then. Like, I'd say half of Hong Kong's population wore masks already then. And I remember finding it so dystopian because this was because of climate change and pollution rather than a virus. But, eventually I was there for a few months and I got accustomed to it. So I think it's not as jarring for me now because I'd had that experience in Hong Kong. I remember thinking that then, that this is crazy. Everybody's walking around with masks. What's going on?
let me tell the audience that, I have this book, well, on my Kindle, and Sensuous Knowledge. Where did you come up with this title? Sensuous Knowledge. Where did you come up with this title in your mind? Where did that come from?
It came to me really suddenly, almost like a flash of lightning or an epiphany or just a phrase that seemed to have a deeper meaning. I was actually in the NASA research camp in San Jose, Silicon Valley, And I was having a swim, and while swimming, this phrase popped into my mind, and then I couldn't quite let go of it. And I think that it had to do with the environment in which I was, which was the very opposite of sensuous knowledge. I mean, it was a great gathering of people who are into ideas and, you know, problem solving, but it was all done in this very technocratic, you know, it was predominantly very privileged men and white people who were there. And I think there was such a lack of soulfulness and embodiment and these kinds of thinking in the conversations that we were having there, that maybe that was what brought the idea of sensuous knowledge to my mind, because sensuousness, in contrast to sensuality, is sensuality is about the senses, so it's about bodily pleasures to do with touch and smell and taste, etc. Sensuousness is the integration of the mind, the body, and the spirit, you could say. So when something is sensuous, it sort of it evokes all of your being, not only your senses but also your mind. And so it was the feeling that I longed for in this setting. And then I also realized, particularly during that event, but, you know, this is something that I've been engaging with for a long time, I think that a lot of the direction that the world is moving toward is being shaped by Silicon Valley, and we don't really think about that enough, but the values that are shaping modern Western societies and increasingly pockets of societies in the global South are really shaped by this Silicon Valley-ist discourse, which has its positives, but certainly it is also part of the problem and the old
problem
thinking that is, yeah.
Well, you talk about that in your book, that, you know, we have all this technology, but we're still not able to solve some of the basic human problems that are going on. Let's start talking about what does Agban Inu and Agban Ori mean to the audience. Explain that those phrases to the audience and what that means, what they mean.
Sure. Thank you so much for that question and for engaging with that particular part of my book. So Agban Inu and Agban Ori, these are concepts, these are Yoruba concepts that form part of the whole, which is Ogbon, which means knowledge. And so the ancient philosophies and myths go that when God created the earth, he gave the people, or he or she, because the Yoruba god is gender neutral, so let's say they gave the people Ogbon, which is knowledge. But God knew that people had to have both a kind of inner knowledge as well as outer knowledge. So you could compare this to emotional and intellectual intelligence. And so she created.
That's how it is. It's in our language. It's in everything. We don't even realize it. It's so like a snake, you know? It's just
so ingrained.
And so ingrained
in
you.
Know what?
Yes.
I have to say, it's really interesting because I very rarely use he as the universal when I'm speaking English. I've kind of reprogrammed my mind. But it's so interesting to me that because we're now speaking about the Yoruba mythology, which is not something I've spoken about as much, my whole sort of upbringing to think of God as he is coming back. So that's quite fascinating. But yes, so Ogbon Inu and Ogbon Ori are basically emotional intelligence and intellectual intelligence. And the whole concept here is that we need to have both. In order to become wise, you need both of these elements, and not just individually, but collectively also. In our societies, we need to, you know, we need to foster emotional intelligence as much as we do focus on the kind of intellectual and reason and rational analyses.
In your book, you talk about the Kenyan novelist, I hope I'm pronouncing the name correctly, Ngugi wa Thiong'o. Is that correct?
I think it's Ngugi wa Thiong'o, but I'm also not Kenyan, so
okay.
I have to be corrected.
Okay, so in the book, yeah. You talk about his phrase that the bullet was the means of physical subjugation, but really language is the root cause of mental colonization. And you talk about the language when you were talking about your friend and you were trying to ask about his name, his African name, in the book. But he always uses, I guess, if you want to say English name. Talk to the audience about why that is so important, that usage of different names and language and how that affects colonization.
Well, what I was really interested in my chapter about decolonization is, on the one hand, the importance of language, which, my entire book, Sensuous Knowledge, is very much engaging with language and what I believe language has the power to transform society. In fact, it is the most powerful tool that we have, language and narrative and so on. And so on the one hand, it is of central importance that we continue to question, colonial languages, whether it's English or Spanish or Portuguese or Arabic or whatever, and what kind of, what stories and what myths and what kind of worldviews these languages bring with them. And this is what Ngugi wa Thiong'o very much centered his book, Decolonizing the Mind, around. And he was arguing that we should move toward or move back to centering indigenous African languages, which I agree is something that we need to definitely not only cherish and celebrate indigenous languages, but bring them into like our politics and our educational systems and so on. At the same time, what that chapter is doing is also suggesting that language is perhaps more malleable than Thiong'o's book did. So even using, we can use the English language or other colonial languages in more creative and playful ways and use languages to reimagine and create egalitarian and elevated societies. And so, and the reason that I'm going there with my argument is because we have to. There have been attempts to bring in more usage of indigenous languages in the African continent, for instance, but this is, we're going on 50 years now and it hasn't really solidified. In fact, the use of English, French, Portuguese, and so on has only been cemented further, largely due to globalization. And so I'm interested in, the whole thinking behind sensuous knowledge is always this kind of synthesis that I mentioned briefly earlier in terms of like connecting the mind and the body and all of that. How do we stay grounded in reality and bring practical efforts and solutions to how we can transform the mess that we're in into something progressive? but yet not do it with this kind of robotic, systemic, oppressive language.
One of the things you talk about is not maybe. I think you talk about Audre Lorde and the master's tools. I think it is you were talking about and using the master's tools to break down, the what is happening. But you go to a next step because I think. In your writing about why you wrote the book, you say this is not a protest book. But how is this not a protest book? Because you're protesting a lot of stuff. Explain to the audience how this is not a protest. You're like, don't do this, don't do that. We should do this, we should do that. Talk to me about why is it not a protest book.
I think the difference is very subtle, and I mentioned that in the book as well. So I say that it is a progress book rather than a protest book. But because progress means, to continue on a journey that has started, for one, it also means to raise consciousness higher. And in order to do those things, there is obviously then an element of protest that comes along, because whenever you're trying to create something new, you are rejecting what has been before. And in fact, you know, in some sense, you could say that offering a new paradigmatic approach to knowledge production is in some ways the highest form of protest, because it's saying that, like, you want to fundamentally uproot what we know, the way that we know, and how we apply what we know. So it's a really subtle thing, but it informed the way that I wrote the book. So the book was more the ideas in it and the writing of it is more rooted in wanting to imagine something new rather than to critique the old.
I think we have a question. I think there's a person. You're calling, the last four digits are 4756. Do you have a question for Mina?
Hello,
good morning.
Yes, ladies. I'm calling from New Orleans. My name is Warren. I also have a show here on Blog Talk Radio. And my question for the guests, in the movie The Wedding Party, there was a scene. You saw that, right, Miss Mina? The Wedding Party?
I'm so bad at remembering movie names. I'm not sure if I have.
Okay, it was one of the Nollywood movies that grossed among the largest grossing. And there was a scene where they had this caterer at the wedding, and one caterer served, traditional European American food, but another caterer was a, you know, Yoruba lady who served the Yoruba food, and everybody loved her food. And I just loved the role she played. She was a strong woman, an entrepreneur, and I imagine her to be the type of women that many African Americans come from during the slave when who were brought over here. And so I just wanted to ask you about that character, if you remember, and the role that women are depicted in Nollywood movies. There.
Well, thank you. What's your name, sir?
Warren from New Orleans.
Warren. Okay, thank you so much, Warren.
Yeah.
Okay, hold on. Let's see what she got to say.
Thanks so much, Warren. I actually, now I know which movie it is, and I haven't seen it, but I've heard so much about it, so I feel like I've seen it almost. And I think I can glean what this scene is about. It's a beautiful way to tie in these conversations. Because, again, we live in a world that is now so globalized, and in which, you know, even in Nigeria, people are having weddings that are westernized, as you would have seen in that movie. In fact, the whole way that the movie is produced is really quite American, like a lot of Nollywood films are. But then at the same time, we still have all of these historical and traditional foods and customs and practices. Even our weddings in Yoruba land, like we have two. When people will get married, they do the traditional wedding, and then they do the white wedding, they call it, the Western variant. You know, because the bride wears the white dress and stuff. And I think that is actually is a bit of a seed to sensuous knowledge, because this is the kind of thinking that I think we urgently have to focus on. We need to synthesize, basically. So if there's one thing that my book is arguing for, it is for syntheses of emotional intelligence and rational thinking, of Western practices, whatever might be useful for us in this day and age, with African traditions and indigenous traditions from everywhere, also learning from the natural world of how to communicate with each other. And so this idea that, like, you know, at a wedding you could have both the traditional food and the Western food, or maybe even like a hybrid of the two, that's actually really, really powerful, I think. And, you know, going back to earlier, we were talking about decolonization and Ngugi Wa Thiong'o's book. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I argue in my book is, you know, I had this friend that I was calling by his Western name, let's say it was Antonio, instead of his Ghanaian name, Kwabena. But why is it that, you know, the African continent cannot sort of like claim anything that is Western? So in Sweden, you have the name Anton. In Mexico, you also have Antonio. And nobody says that, this isn't an authentic Mexican name. But in, mm-hmm. in the African continent, we keep doing that. And I think in some sense, we also need to claim what Western practices that we've been we've been using now for centuries, you know.
You know,
sort of
Mina, let me just interrupt you, because also in your book you talk about blackness and that Africans are unable to embrace blackness. Tell us a little bit about the Uni. He is a high priest. Talk to the audience about that experience and how when he spoke to the African-Americans versus when he spoke to the white Europeans, that little story there.
Yeah, so the Oni of Ife is the highest embodiment of the divine in Yoruba culture. And the current Oni is the leader of Yoruba people all around the world. So we're talking about, you know, millions of people. And I was fortunate to visit and himself and interview him. And while I was there, you know, I had so many incredible and insightful experiences, both good and bad. Bad in the sense of that it was, it's a culture that is so steeped in tradition that I think that can become problematic if we can't sort of loosen our ties to tradition. But anyway, what was extremely beautiful was the Oni gave a speech one of the days that I was there. He gave a speech to a bunch of white American men that had come from the American embassy, and they wanted to build some kind of memorial in Ife. And he welcomed them to Ife. He said, "Welcome home." And they blushed because they're white and they come from America, so they know that there's these tensions. But he then explained that, look, you know, this is the cradle of humanity. He said Africa, and even more specifically Ife, because this is our belief in Yoruba land, is that Ife is the cradle of humanity. And so you come from here, even though you have now dispersed. And it was a really beautiful and very humanist speech, which, you know, you could analyze. And I took issue with knowing that people like that are often coming to exploit. And so it's kind of this double-edged sword. On the one hand, very typically culture, the Oni was showing this almost a bit of an arrogance and a pride, and like, this is where humanity started. But at the same time, it's almost being too kind to people who don't always have our best intentions at heart. But in any case, later that day, a bunch of musicians and artists and creatives from the diaspora, so Black people, predominantly Black Americans, but also Caribbeans and Latin Americans, we all convened, and the Oni of Ife gave the same speech, pretty much, to this group of people. And it was just something about the energy and the way that this speech resounded when it was a room full of Black people from around the globe. And this sentiment of when he said, "Welcome home," you know, that really pierced my heart and my mind and everything, because we were so connected. And that moment for me was what I think blackness is. That sense that we, you know, we weren't necessarily connected by blood in any kind of direct way, but we were all of us in that room were connected by the trajectory of our social history, of like the journeys that we've been on, the journeys that our ancestors were on, the kind of philosophical and spiritual beliefs that inform our lineage, even if we don't follow them strictly, you know. But everybody kind of knew exactly what was meant by that statement, "Welcome home," and nobody blushed, you know, like earlier in the day.
Unlike the other people. Now, you talk about in the story about womanhood, and you also talk about the waves of feminism. First, let's talk about the womanhood. You talk about the color blue. When I think of the color blue now, I think of boy. I think of man, because even as you say in your book, I mean, as soon as the woman is born, it's just that's it. That her life is defined, and the color pink comes in because you go to people's rooms for the baby. It's pink or it's blue, or now they use green or yellow or something like that if they don't know. Talk to them about the goddess, I think it's Asi. Asi, is that what I'm saying correctly?
Yes, the goddess Asi. So in my book, I have a chapter that about womanhood that starts with the sentence that blue is a feminine color in Africa. And here's a perfect example, actually, between progress and protest, because what this chapter is doing is, I'm showing how something that we take for granted that is part of this Euro-patriarchal knowledge and worldview that has shaped all of our lives and that has coded particular behavior. So blue is for boys because boys are powerful, dominant, this, that, and pink is for girls because we're actually, when you look at a different continent and a different people's history and stories, we're talking millions of people in an area of geography that's so much larger than Europe. It's blue is actually a feminine color. And so then I go on to kind of merge history with my own personal experiences and feminist theory and using blue as a catalyst of a way to reimagine what womanhood can mean, and ultimately in a way that signifies a sense of personhood and self-reliance that this categorization of blue and pink in the West has deprived women of. And so, there's a sense here that obviously I'm protesting against the ways that I myself had to experience these limiting and oppressive categorizations. But more than that, I'm interested in just bringing in that color blue in a way that affects the reader not only socially and politically, but also psychologically and almost spiritually in a sense, so that whenever you are given some kind of easy code about blue and pink or whatever, you will just think twice. If nothing else, you will just think twice. That is it really this rigid?
So now we have another caller. Let's see if they have a question. You're calling from 215-266. The number is, do you have a question for the guest, Nina? Hello? Okay, maybe they just want to listen. Yeah. That's okay.
Okay, no problem.
Let's talk about these waves of feminism. In your book, you talking about there's almost four or five waves of feminism. Can you tell the audience what these are?
Four or five waves of feminism? I'm not quite sure.
Well, okay, you first start off with the first wave of feminism is in the 19th century. And it was...
Oh, wave. Okay,
waves.
Sorry.
I'm sorry.
Waves.
Oh, waves. Waves like ocean waves, sorry.
Now I've got it. Yeah, no, I should have said
okay,
that.
Okay.
There's a tendency to categorize the feminist movement in waves. They aren't, it's not a neat process, but you have the first wave of feminism in the late 20th century when it was about such first and foremost, and it's kind of it's connected also to the abolition movement. And then you have the second wave of feminism, which is during the 60s and 70s, when you had the invention of the birth control pill and the whole, there'd been the Second World War and women had come out of that in the West, especially, and starting work and whatnot. And then the third wave, which starts around the 90s and has to do with race and gender and class largely impacting, and then also the creation of gender studies and women's studies in universities. And what I argue in the book, which is not really an argument, it's a fact, is that all of these waves of feminism were deeply influenced, and even you could say created by Black women. So obviously the abolition was something where both Black women and men, so people like Frederick Douglass and Sojourner Truth were the key shapers. But now Sojourner Truth didn't have the platform that either a Black man, but even more importantly, that white women could have. Mm-hmm. So a lot of her ideas were propagated by the white feminists in this first wave. In the second wave, the feminist movement was directly created because you had women who were working with civil rights organizations. So quite similar to what we have today with Black Lives Matter, there was that sentiment going on. But a lot of these women who got involved in the civil rights got angry because they realized that they were having to take a back seat within these movements because of their gender. With a third wave, you have, I mean, it was coined by Alice Walker's daughter, Rebecca Walker, so a Black woman, and, you know, it's very much shaped, as I said, by questions of race and class, which is something that Black women and other women of color contributed to the movement. And also you could argue that what we have now is the fourth wave of feminism, which is very much shaped by social media, you know, Me Too and all of the feminist blogs and so on that have emerged in the past decade or two. And again, you know, what are the leading energies of this movement? It's terminologies like intersectionality, created by a Black feminist.
That's the thing that's interesting, you know, because people didn't know that at first. You know, they did not know that it was a Black woman who had, you know, was the catalyst for the Me Too situation. Let's bring that to what's happening now. I don't know if you're familiar a lot with what's happening now in America and the George Floyd and how that was the catalyst for a lot of the protests that are going on in America.
Of course,
But they are not aware and not really promoting what is happening to women. How is that over in London? Has that happened there too? Are men more held up as the catalyst for maybe a great movement, and yet these same things are happening to Black women in London? Is that going on over there as well?
That is going on over here and has been going on for so long. You know, the narrative and the stories about the Black emancipation movement in the UK and in all of Europe centered on Black men's contributions and antagonism toward white supremacy. And the same, of course, applies very widely to the African continent. And, you know, this is a real problem that is so underplayed and undermined within the Black struggle. And it has to do with the real lack of agency and dehumanization of women that we are yet to grapple with in Black communities on a full scale. And I think what we end up doing quite often is like importing and adopting the narrative of gender struggle that you know, that is Western and that exists in white communities, and a lot of that informs the Black struggle too, but we also have to really look at the specifics of what has happened between Black women and men. You know, if white people didn't exist, and if we just looked at our own history and our own trajectories of gender relations, what is really going on? Like, this is a question that we need to engage with at depth. And one of the central things that happens, I think, when we look at it this way is, you know, we can see that Black men, because they face so many attacks toward this idea of masculinity that informs Black manhood, very generally, aggression is taken out on Black women. And that is not only taken out by means of violence, which also happens in disturbing amounts, but also and precisely in erasure. And diminishing and making it makes our contribution to knowledge production and to society invisible. And this
you
is
talk
a,
about
this
knowledge. Let's
struggle.
Just stick on that one more the knowledge there, right there. We only have a couple of minutes. I know I have to let you go, but the issue of that knowledge is what do you call it? What did you say? It's basically it's like equal, but it's really not. It's Euro-patriarchal. We think the things that we're learning are, I guess, like the truth, but the way we're viewed and the way they're taught, they're not the truth. Could you expound on that? Do you understand what I'm trying to say?
I think I do. So what I really want to leave listeners with, is that, and especially Black women, is that what we know, our experiences, how we've been raised, what we've been taught about ourselves, and what we actually do, and how we relate with each other, and the kinds of things that we invent, and the theories that we create, all of these things are central to not only what we might call Black thought, but to global thought. And we have the human right to make those ideas visible and to claim them and position them as vital ingredients in the whole sort of fabric of knowledge production. That is a right that has been taken away from us by all other groups in society. And it is high time that we start to claim that right and position our knowledge as central, first and foremost, in our own lives rather than other groups' knowledge, but also to the whole pool of knowledge as a whole.
Okay, some fun questions here. We talked about a lot of deep stuff here. What's your favorite author, other than yourself, of course?
I'm not even my favorite author. Writing is such a hard process. I don't know. You can't make me choose. But
okay, how about three? Give me three.
Thank you.
Okay.
So then I'm going to go with bell hooks, Toni Morrison, and Sophie Bosade Oluwole, a Nigerian philosopher.
Okay, how about music? Top three musicians you like?
I love Sade, and I'm just going to give you a genre. I really love soul music. I can't pick. There's just so many, many people. But I do like, I like a lot of the modern soul music, but I guess, you know, in terms of favorites, people like Sade, Tracy Chapman, Bob Marley, Indiary, Lauryn Hill. I'm going to go
with Lauryn. Yeah, you talk about Lauryn in your book. Yeah.
She's definitely a favorite.
When you leave the house, what do you have to have in your pocketbook? Like you've got to have this thing in your pocketbook. Like, you can't go out the house.
At the moment, it's like hand sanitizer. But normally, I mean, you know, my phone. But lipstick. I have a thing about even when I write, if I know that I'm going to be at home all day by myself, I'm not going to see a single person. But I put on lipstick. It kind of brings. I feel like it brings in a feminine touch to my work and to my day.
All right. I think that's a good note to end. Thank you so much for taking time today to do the interview all the way across the ocean. I want to thank the audience for listening. Please listen, follow her. She has Miss on the web. She's on Twitter. She's on Instagram. Check her out on all those places. And what do you have coming up next? Are you working on any big projects other than the book? What's coming up next for you?
I'm writing a series for a think tank called Perspectiva, and it's a series of essays about exusions, which is a concept I coined in my book. It's an alternative way to look at power, and so I'm building on that in this series of essays. And if anybody's interested in them, you can check my Instagram page where I've got some posts about it. It's very much about connecting Black feminism with spirituality and with nature. So themes that I think are really important today in our time.
Selena, guess what? I didn't know that you knew Suleiman Adonia. He was just on the show earlier.
Oh, no way. That's pretty good.
I was reading your book, and I said he talks about he thanks you because you helped him with meditation. How has meditation helped you in your life? Just the clarity, how has it helped you?
Oh, meditation is, like, you know, you asked me what I would put in my bag whenever I leave my house. Meditation is like what I put in my, you know, what I need to get by with each day, what I need to create ideas, what I need to learn, to grow, to have good relationships. It's something that I see as both kind of self-development on an individual level, but I also meditate so that I can be of better service. And I think that people, anyone who wants to be of service to humanity and to their communities, should be meditating, because it just helps us to center ourselves and to speak from a place of compassion and wisdom. So meditation is really, really important. Yeah.
I agree. Well, thank you so much again for coming on. I'm going to release you, and you can go meditate or write some more or put some lipstick on. Thank you.
Or
thank
all
you,
three.
Thank you.
Huge thanks to you, three. Joy. It was such a pleasure. Thanks.
Okay,
to the
I'm going
to
be giving some copies of your book away, so I just want to let the audience know. And stay tuned on the social media for the giveaway opportunity. Thank you so much, Nina, for coming on today.
Thanks. Thank you, Joy.
Okay.
Take care. Have a
I'll
great
talk
day.
To you later. You too. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye.
Okay, everybody, you can follow me at Joy Keys on Twitter. Check me out on Facebook, Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. Also on Instagram, Saturdays with Joy Keys. You want to follow, if you want to get a copy of Nina's book or Suleiman's book, you definitely want to follow so you can find out how you can win. Most of the times I tell people, email me the answer of the quiz. You might be the winner. You never know. So check them out. Also check her out, Miss Afropolitan. She has a website, like she was saying, talk about her writing. And Suleiman, he's on Twitter. You can check him out there. Have a great day. Remember, we're still in this COVID madness. Cover your face, your nose, your mouth. If you got gloves, make sure you wash your hands frequently. But besides all that, I hope you have a wonderful day.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is working to help keep you and your community safe from the threat of novel or new coronavirus. Take the following everyday steps to help avoid the spread of all respiratory viruses. Wash your hands often with soap and water for at least 20 seconds. Cover your cough or sneeze with a tissue. Throw the tissue away and then wash your hands. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects or surfaces, such as remote controls and doorknobs. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. And stay home if you are sick. Call your healthcare provider if you develop fever, cough, or difficulty breathing. For more tips, visit cdc.gov.